There, said Draco hoarsely. Once upon a time, there was a girl, and her name was Narcissa, and she was the prettiest, the smartest, the most cunning girl that was ever sorted into Slytherin. And my father loved her, and they married, and she wasn't a Death Eater. She wasn't a fighter. All she ever did was love father.
Draco stopped there because he was crying. Harry felt sick to his stomach. Draco had never talked about his mother. Not once. He should have noticed that earlier.
She got in the way of a curse.
Draco's voice came out in a scream.
Dumbledore burned her to death in her own bedroom!
In a classroom filled with soft silver light, one boy is staring at another boy, who's sobbing, wiping frantically at his eyes with the sleeves of his robes. It was hard for Harry to stay balanced, to keep withholding judgment. It was too emotional. There was something that either wanted to start tears from his own eyes in sympathy with Draco, or know that it wasn't true. Dumbledore burned her to death in her own bedroom. That didn't sound like Dumbledore's style. But you could only think that thought so many times before you started to wonder about the trustworthiness of that whole style concept.
It must have hurt horribly, Draco said, his voice shaking. Father never talks about it at all. You don't ever talk about it in front of him. But Mr. McNair told me there were scorch marks all over the bedroom from how Mother must have struggled while Dumbledore burned her alive. That is the debt Dumbledore owes to House Malfoy. And we will have his life for it.
Draco,
Harry said. He let all of the hoarseness into his own voice. It would be wrong to sound calm.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for asking. But I have to know. How do you know it was
Dumbledore said he did it. He told Father it was a warning. And Father couldn't testify under Veritaserum because he was an Occlumens and couldn't even get Dumbledore put on trial. Father's own allies didn't believe him after Dumbledore just denied everything in public. But we know. The Death Eaters know. Father wouldn't have any reason to lie about that. Father would want us to take revenge on the right person. Can't you see that, Harry?
Draco's voice was wild.
Unless Lucius did it himself, of course, and found it more convenient to blame Dumbledore.
Although, it also didn't seem like Lucius's style. And if he had murdered Narcissa, it would have been smarter to pin the blame on an easier victim, instead of losing political capital and credibility by going after Dumbledore. In time, Draco stopped crying and looked at Harry.
Well,
said Draco, sounding like he wanted to spit the words.
Is that evil enough for you, Mr. Potter?
Harry looked down at where his arms rested on the back of his chair. He couldn't meet Draco's eyes any more. The pain in them was too raw.
I wasn't expecting to hear that,
Harry said softly.
I don't know what to think any more.
You don't know!
Draco's voice rose to a shriek, and he stood up abruptly from his desk.
I remembered the Dark Lord killing my parents, Harry said. When I went in front of the Dementor for the first time, that was when I remembered the worst memory. Even though it was so long ago, I heard them dying. My mother begged the Dark Lord not to kill me. Not Harry, please, take me. Kill me instead. That's what she said. And the Dark Lord mocked her and laughed. Then I remember the flash of green light.
Harry looked up at Draco.
So, we could fight,
Harry said.
We could just keep on with the same fight. You could tell me that it was right for my mother to die because she was the wife of James who killed a Death Eater. But bad for your mother to die because she was innocent. And I could tell you that it was right for your mother to die, that Dumbledore must have had some reason that made it okay to burn her alive in her own bedroom, but bad for my mother to die. But, you know, Draco, either way, wouldn't it be obvious that we were just being biased? Because the rule that says that it's wrong to kill innocent people, that rule can't switch on for my mother and off for yours, and it can't switch on for your mother and off for mine. If you tell me that Lily was an enemy of the Death Eaters, and it's right to kill your enemies, then the same rule says that Dumbledore was right to kill Narcissa, since she was his enemy.
Harry's voice went hoarse.
So, if the two of us are going to agree on anything, it's going to be that neither of their deaths were right, and that no one's mother should die anymore.
The fury boiling inside Draco was so great that he could barely stop himself from storming out of the room. All that halted him was the recognition of a critical moment, and a small remnant of friendship. A tiny flash of sympathy, for he had forgotten. He had forgotten that Harry's mother and father were dead by the Dark Lord's hand. The silence stretched.
"You can talk,"
Harry said.
"Draco, talk to me. I won't get angry. Are you thinking, I don't know, that Narcissa dying was much worse than Lily dying, and it's wrong for me even to make the comparison?
I guess I was stupid too,"
Draco said.
All this time I forgot that you must hate the Death Eaters for killing your parents. Hate the Death Eaters the way I hate Dumbledore."
And Harry had never said anything. Never reacted when Draco talked about Death Eaters. Kept it hidden. Draco was a fool.
"No,"
Harry said.
It's not like that, Draco. I don't even know how to explain to you, except to say that a thought like that wouldn't..."
Harry's voice choked.
You wouldn't ever be able to use it to cast the Patronus charm."
Draco felt a sudden wrench in his heart. Unwanted, but he felt it.
"Are you pretending you're just going to forget about your own parents? Are you saying I should just forget
about Mother.
So, you and I have to be enemies, then.
Now Harry's voice was growing equally wild.
What have we ever done to each other that means we have to be enemies? I refuse to be trapped like that. Justice can't mean that both of us should attack each other. It doesn't make sense.
Harry stopped, took a deep breath, ran his fingers back through the deliberate mess of his hair. The fingers came away sweaty. Draco could see it.
Draco, listen. We can't expect to meet on everything right away, you and I. So, I won't ask you to say that the Dark Lord was wrong to kill my mother. Just say that it was sad. We won't talk about whether or not it was necessary, whether it was justified. I'll just ask you to say that it was sad that it happened. That my mother's life was valuable too. You'll just say that for now. And I'll say it was sad that Narcissa died, because her life was also worth something. We can't expect to agree on everything right away. But if we start out by saying that every life is precious, that it's sad when anyone dies, then I know we'll meet someday. That's what I want you to say. Not who was right, not who was wrong. Just that it was sad when your mother died, and sad when my mother died, and it would be sad if Hermione Granger died. Every life is precious. Can we agree on that? And let the rest go by for now. Is it enough? We just agree on that. Can we, Draco? That seems more like a thought someone could use to cast the Patronus charm.
There were tears in Harry's eyes. And Draco was getting angry again.
Dumbledore killed Mother. It's not enough to just say it's sad. I don't understand what you think you have to do, but the Malfoys have to take revenge.
Not avenging the deaths of family went beyond weakness, beyond dishonor. You might as well not exist.
I'm not arguing with that,
Harry said quietly.
But will you say that Lily Potter's death was sad? Just that one thing.
That's...
Draco was having difficulty finding words again.
I know how you feel. But don't you see, Harry? Even if I just say that Lily Potter's death was sad, that's already going against the Death Eaters.
Draco, you've got to be able to say the Death Eaters were wrong about some things. You have to. You can't progress as a scientist otherwise. There'll be a roadblock in your way, an authority you can't contradict. Not every change is an improvement, but every improvement is a change. You can't do anything better unless you can manage to do it differently. You've got to let yourself do better than other people. Even your father, Draco. Even him. You've got to be able to point to something your father did and say it was mistaken because he wasn't perfect. And if you can't say that, you can't do better.
Father had warned him. Every night, before he went to sleep, for a month before he went to Hogwarts, that there would be people with this goal.
You're trying to break me loose of Father!
Trying to break a part of you loose, said Harry. Trying to let you fix some things your father got mistaken. Trying to let you do better, but not trying to break your Patronus.
Harry's voice got softer.
I wouldn't want to break something bright like that. Who knows? Fixing Slytherin House might need that, too.
It was getting to Draco. That was the thing. Despite everything, it was getting to him. You had to be really careful around Harry because his arguments sounded so convincing, even when he was wrong.
And what you're not admitting is that Dumbledore told you that you could avenge your parents' deaths by taking Lord Malfoy's son from him.
No, no, that part's just wrong.
Harry took a deep breath.
I didn't know who Dumbledore was, or who the Dark Lord was, or who the Death Eaters were, or how my parents died until 3 days before I came to Hogwarts. The day you and I first met in the clothes shop, that was the day I learned. And Dumbledore doesn't even like Muggle science, or he says he doesn't. I got a chance to probe him on it once. The thought of taking revenge on the Death Eaters through you has never crossed my mind. Not even once, until now. I didn't know who the Malfoys were when I met you in the clothes shop, and then I liked you.
There was a long silence.
I wish I could trust you, Draco said.
His voice was shaking.
If I could just know you were telling the truth, everything would be so much simpler.
And then suddenly, it came to Draco. The way to know whether Harry Potter really meant everything he said about wanting to fix Slytherin House, about being sad that Mother had died. It would be illegal, and since he'd have to do it without Father's help, it would be dangerous. He couldn't even trust Harry Potter to help, but...
All right, Draco said. I've thought of a definitive experiment.
What is it?
I want to give you a drop of Veritaserum, Draco said. Just one drop, so you can't lie, but not enough to make you answer anything. I don't know where I'll get it, but I'll make certain it's safe.
Harry said. There was a helpless look on his face.
Draco,
don't say it, Draco said.
His voice was firm and calm.
If you say no, that's my experimental result right there.
Draco, I'm an Occlumens.
Oh, that's such a lie!
I was trained by Mr. Bester. Professor Quirrell set it up. Look, Draco, I'll take one drop of Veritaserum if you can get it. I'm just warning you that I'm an Occlumens. Not a perfect Occlumens, but Mr. Bester said I was putting up a complete block, and I could probably beat Veritaserum.
You're in your first year at Hogwarts. That's just crazy.
No, Allegilimens, you can trust. I'll be happy to demonstrate. Look, Draco, I'm sorry, but doesn't the fact that I told you count for something? I could have just let you do it, you know?
Why? Why are you always like this, Harry? Why do you have to mess everything up even when it's impossible? And stop smiling! This isn't funny!
I'm sorry. I know it's not funny.
It took a while for Draco to get himself under control. But Harry was right. Harry could have just let Draco administer the Veritaserum. If he really was an Occlumens, Draco didn't know who he could ask to try legitimacy. But he could at least ask Professor Quirrell if it was true. Could Draco trust Professor Quirrell? Maybe Professor Quirrell would just say anything Harry asked him to. Then Draco remembered the other thing Harry had told him to ask Professor Quirrell and thought of a different test.
"You know," said Draco. "You know what it costs me if I agree that the poison in Slytherin's house is hating Muggleborns, and say that Lily Potter's death was sad. And that's part of your plan. Don't tell me it's not."
Harry said nothing, which was wise of him.
"There's something I want from you in return," said Draco. "And before then, an experimental test I want to try."
Draco pushed open the door to which the portraits had directed them, and this time it was the right door. Before them was a small empty place of stone set against the night sky. Not a roof like the one he'd dropped Harry from, but a tiny and proper courtyard far above the ground, with proper railings, elaborate traceries of stone that flushed seamlessly into the stone floor. How so much artistry had been infused into the creation of Hogwarts was something that still awed Draco every time he thought about it. There must have been some way to do it all at once. No one could have detailed so much piece by piece. The castle changed, and every new piece was like that. It was so far beyond the wizardry of these fading days that no one would have believed it if they hadn't seen the proof of it in Hogwarts itself. Cloudless and cold, the winter night sky. It got dark long before students' curfew in the final days of January. The stars, shining brightly in the clear air. Harry had said that being under the stars would help him. Draco touched his chest with his wand, slid his fingers in a practiced motion, and said, "Thermos!" A warmth spread through him, starting from his heart. The wind went on blowing on his face, but it was no longer cold.
"Thermos!"
Harry's voice said behind him. They went together to the railing, to look down at the ground a long way below. Draco tried to figure out if they were in one of the towers that could be seen from the outside, and found that right now he couldn't quite seem to picture how Hogwarts looked from the outside. But the ground below was always the same. He could see the Forbidden Forest as a vague outline, and moonlight glittering from the Hogwarts lake.
"You know,"
Harry's voice said quietly from beside him, where his arms leaned on the railing next to Draco's,
"one of the things that Muggles get really wrong is that they don't turn all their lights out at night. Not even for 1 hour every month. Not even for 15 minutes once a year. The photons scatter in the atmosphere and wash out all but the brightest stars, and the night sky doesn't look the same at all. Not unless you go far away from any cities. Once you've looked up at the sky over Hogwarts, it's hard to imagine living in a Muggle city, where you wouldn't be able to see the stars. You certainly wouldn't want to spend your whole life in Muggle cities, once you had seen the night sky over Hogwarts."
Draco glanced at Harry and found that Harry was craning his neck to stare up at where the Milky Way arched across the darkness.
"Of course," Harry went on, his voice still quiet, "you can't ever see the stars properly from Earth, either. The air always gets in the way. You have to look from somewhere else if you want to see the real thing. The stars, burning hard and bright, like their true selves. Have you ever wished that you could just whisk yourself up into the night sky, Draco, and go look at what there is to see around other suns than ours? If there were no limit to the power of your magic, is that one of the things you'd do? If you could do anything?"
There was a silence, and then Draco realized that he was expected to answer.
"I didn't think of it before,"
Draco said. Without any conscious decision, his voice came out as soft and hushed as Harry's.
"Do you really think anyone would ever be able to do that?" "I don't think it'll be that easy," said Harry. "But I know I don't mean to spend my whole life on Earth."
It would have been something to laugh at if Draco hadn't known that some Muggles had already left, without even using magic.
"To pass your test," Harry said, "I'm going to have to say what it means to me, that thought. The whole thing. Not the shorter version I tried to explain to you before. But you should be able to see it's the same idea, only more general. So, my version of the thought, Draco, is that when we go out into the stars, we might find other people there. And if so, they certainly won't look like we do. There might be things out there that are grown from crystal, or big pulsating blobs, or they might be made of magic, now that I think about it. So, with all that strangeness, how do you recognize a person? Not by the shape, not by how many arms or legs it has, not by the sort of substance it's made out of. Whether that's flesh or crystal or stuff I can't imagine. You would have to recognize them as people from their minds. And even their minds wouldn't work just like ours do, but anything that lives and thinks and knows itself and doesn't want to die. It's sad, Draco. It's sad if that person has to die. Because it doesn't want to. Compared to what might be out there, every human being who ever lived were all like brothers and sisters. You could hardly even tell us apart. The ones out there who met us, they wouldn't see British or French. They wouldn't be able to tell the difference. They'd just see a human being. Humans who can love and hate and laugh and cry, and to them, the ones out there, they'd make us all as alike as peas in the same pod. They would be different, though, really different. But that wouldn't stop us, and it wouldn't stop them, if we both wanted to be friends together.
Harry raised his wand then, and Draco turned and looked away as he had promised. Looked toward the stone floor and stone wall in which the door was set, for Draco had promised not to look, and not to tell anyone of what Harry had said, or anything at all of what happened here this night, though he didn't know why it was to be so secret.
"I have a dream," said Harry's voice. that one day sentient beings will be judged by the pattern of their minds and not their color or their shape or the stuff they're made of or who their parents were. Because if we can get along with crystal things someday, how silly would it be not to get along with Muggleborns who are shaped like us and think like us, as alike to us as peas in a pod. The crystal things wouldn't even be able to tell the difference. How impossible is it to imagine that the hatred poisoning Slytherin House would be worth taking with us to the stars? Every life is precious. Everything that thinks and knows itself and doesn't want to die. Lily Potter's life was precious, and Narcissa Malfoy's life was precious. Even though it's too late for them now, it was sad when they died. But there are other lives that are still alive to be fought for. Your life, and my life, and Hermione Granger's life. All the lives of Earth, and all the lives beyond, to be defended and protected. Expecto Patronum!
And there was light. Everything turned to silver in that light. The stone floor, the stone wall, the door, the railings, so dazzling just in the reflection that you could hardly even see them. Even the air seemed to shine. And the light grew brighter, and brighter, and brighter. When the light ended, it was like a shock. Draco's hand went automatically to his robe to bring out a handkerchief, and it was only then that he realized he was crying.
"There is your experimental result,"
Harry's voice said quietly.
"I really did mean it, that thought."
Draco slowly turned toward Harry, who had lowered his wand now.
That's got to be a trick, right?"
Draco said. He couldn't take many more of these shocks.
"Your Patronus can't really be that bright."
And yet it had been Patronus light. Once you knew what you were looking at, you couldn't mistake it for anything else.
"That was the true form of the Patronus charm," Harry said. "Something that lets you put all your strength into the Patronus without hindrance from within yourself. And before you ask, I didn't learn it from Dumbledore. He doesn't know the secret, and couldn't cast the true form if he did. I solved the puzzle for myself, and I knew, once I understood, that this spell must not be spoken of. For your sake, I undertook your test, but you must not speak of it, Draco."
Draco didn't know any more. He didn't know where the true strength lay, or the right of things. Double vision. Double vision. Draco wanted to call Harry's ideals weakness. Hufflepuff foolishness. The sort of lie that rulers told to placate the populace, and that Harry had been silly enough to believe for himself. Foolishness taken seriously and raised up to insane heights, projected out onto the stars themselves. Something beautiful and hidden, mysterious and bright.
"Will I," whispered Draco, "be able to cast a Patronus like that someday?"
"If you always keep seeking the truth," Harry said, "and if you don't refuse the warm thoughts when you find them, then I'm sure you will. I think a person could get anywhere if they just kept going long enough, even to the stars."
Draco wiped his eyes with his handkerchief again.
"We should go back inside," Draco said in an unsteady voice. "Someone could have seen it. All that light."
Harry nodded and moved to and through the door, and Draco looked up at the night sky one last time before he followed. Who was the boy who lived that he was already an Occlumens, and could cast the true form of the Patronus charm, and do other strange things? What was Harry's Patronus? Why must it stay unseen? Draco didn't ask any of those questions because Harry might have answered, and Draco just couldn't take any more shocks today. He just couldn't. One more shock, and his head was going to just fall right off his shoulders and go bounce, bounce, bounce down the corridors of Hogwarts. Ned ducked into a small alcove, instead of going all the way back to the classroom at Draco's request. He was feeling too nervous to put it off any longer. Draco put up a quieting barrier, and then looked at Harry in silent question.
"I've been thinking about it," Harry said. "I'll do it, but there are 5 conditions."
"5?"
"Yes, 5. Look, Draco, a pledge like this is just begging to go terribly wrong somehow. You know it would go wrong if this were a play."
"Well, it's not," Draco said. "Dumbledore killed Mother. He's evil. It's one of those things you talk about that doesn't have to be complicated."
"Draco,"
Harry said, his voice careful.
"All I know is that you say that Lucius says that Dumbledore says he killed Narcissa. To believe that unquestioningly, I have to trust you and Lucius and Dumbledore. So, like I said, there are conditions. The first one is that at any point you can release me from the pledge, if it no longer seems like a good idea. It has to be a deliberate and intended decision on your part, of course, not a trick of wording or something."
"Okay,"
said Draco. That sounded safe enough.
"Condition 2 is that I'm pledging to take as an enemy whoever actually did kill Narcissa, as determined to the honest best of my ability as a rationalist. Whether that's Dumbledore or someone else. And you have my word that I'll exercise my best ability as a rationalist to keep that judgment honest, as a question of simple fact. Agreed?"
"I don't like it," said Draco.
He didn't. The whole point was to make sure Harry never went with Dumbledore. Still, if Harry was honest, he'd catch on to Dumbledore soon enough. And if dishonest, he'd already broken his word.
"But I'll agree."
"Condition 3 is that Narcissa has to have been burned alive. If that part of the story turns out to be something exaggerated, just to make it sound a little worse, then I get to decide for myself whether or not to still go through with the pledge. Good people sometimes have to kill, but they don't ever torture people to death. It's because Narcissa was burned alive that I know whoever did that was evil."
Draco kept his temper. Barely.
"Condition 4 is that if Narcissa got her own hands dirty and, say, crucioed someone's child into insanity, and that person burned Narcissa for revenge, the deal might be off again, because then it was still wrong for them to burn her. They still should have just killed her without pain, but it wasn't evil, the same way as if she was just Lucius's love, who never did anything herself, like you said. Condition 5 is that if whoever killed Narcissa was tricked somehow into doing it, then my enemy is whoever tricked them, not the person who was tricked.
All this really sounds like you're planning to weasel out of it.
Draco, I won't take a good person as an enemy. Not for you, or anyone. I have to really believe they're in the wrong. But I've thought about it, and it seems to me that if Narcissa didn't do any evil with her own hands, just fell in love with Lucius and chose to stay his wife, then whoever burned her alive in her own bedroom isn't likely to be a good guy, and I'll pledge to take as my enemy whoever made that happen, whether it's Dumbledore or anyone else, unless you deliberately release me from that pledge. Hopefully, that won't go the wrong way it would if this were a play.
I'm not happy, said Draco. But okay. You pledge to take my mother's murderer as your enemy, and I'll...
Harry waited with a patient look on his face while Draco tried to make his voice work again.
I'll help you fix the problem with Slytherin House hating Muggleborns,
Draco finished in a whisper.
And I'll say it was sad that Lily Potter died.
So be it, said Harry.
And it was done. The break, Draco knew, had just widened a little more. No, not a little. A lot. There was a sensation of drifting away, of being lost, further and further from shore, further and further from home.
Excuse me, Draco said.
He turned away from Harry and then tried to calm himself. He had to do this test, and he didn't want to fail it from being nervous or ashamed. Draco raised his wand into the starting position for the Patronus charm. Remembered falling from his broomstick. The pain. The fear. Imagined it coming from a tall figure in a cloak, looking like a dead thing left in water. And then Draco closed his eyes, the better to remember Father holding his small, cold hands in his own warm strength.
"Don't be frightened, my son. I'm here."
The wand swung up in a broad brandish to drive the fear away, and Draco was surprised at the strength of it, and he remembered in that moment that Father wasn't lost, would never be lost, would always be there and strong in his own person, no matter what happened to Draco. And his voice cried,
"Expecto Patronum!"
Draco opened his eyes. A shining snake looked back at him, no less bright than before. Behind him, he heard Harry exhale a breath, as though in relief. Draco gazed into the white light. It seemed he wasn't lost completely after all.
That reminds me, said Harry after a while. Can we test my hypothesis about how to use a Patronus to send messages?
Is it going to surprise me? Said Draco. I don't want any more surprises today.
Harry had claimed that the idea wasn't all that strange, and he didn't see how it could possibly shock Draco in any way, which made Draco feel even more nervous somehow. But Draco could see how important it was to have a way of sending messages in emergencies. The trick, or so Harry hypothesized, was wanting to spread the good news, wanting the recipient to know the truth of whatever happy thought you'd used to cast the Patronus charm, only, instead of telling the recipient in words, the Patronus itself was the message. By wanting them to see that, the Patronus would go to them.
"Tell Harry,"
said Draco to the luminous snake, even though Harry was standing only a few paces away on the other side of the room,
"to, beware the green monkey."
This being a sign from a play Draco had once seen. And then, just like at King's Cross Station, Draco wanted Harry to know that Father had always cared for him. Only, this time, he didn't try to say it in words, but wanted to say it with the happy thought itself. The bright snake slithered across the room, looking more like it was slithering through the air rather than the stone itself. It got to Harry after travelling that short distance, and said to Harry, in a strange voice that Draco recognised as how he himself probably sounded to other people,
"Beware the green monkey!"
said Harry. The snake slithered back across the floor to Draco.
"Harry says the message is received and acknowledged,"
said the shining blue crate in Draco's voice.
"Huh," Harry said. "Talking to Patronuses feels odd." "Why are you looking at me like that?"
said the heir of Slytherin. Harry stared at Draco.
"You just been magical snakes, right?"
No, said Draco.
He was looking rather pale and was still stammering, but had at least stopped the incoherent noises he'd been making earlier.
"You're a parcel mouth. You can speak parcel tongue. It's the language of all snakes everywhere. You can understand any snake when it talks, and they can understand when you talk to them. Harry, you can't possibly believe you were sorted into Ravenclaw. You're the heir of Slytherin!"
"Snakes are sentient!"
Chapter 48. Utilitarian Priorities. It was Saturday, the first morning of February, and at the Ravenclaw table, a boy, bearing a breakfast plate heaped high with vegetables, was nervously inspecting his servings for the slightest trace of meat. It might have been an overreaction. After he'd gotten over the raw shock, Harry's common sense had woken up and hypothesized that parcel tongue was probably just a linguistic user interface for controlling snakes. After all, snakes couldn't really be human-level intelligent. Someone would have noticed by now. The smallest-brained creatures that Harry had ever heard of with anything like linguistic ability were the African grey parrots taught by Irene Pepperberg, and that was unstructured proto-language in a species that played complex games of adultery and needed to model other parrots. While, according to what Draco had been able to remember, snakes spoke to parcel mouths in what sounded like normal human language, i.e., full-blown, recursive, syntactical grammar. That had taken time for hominids to evolve, with huge brains and strong social selection pressures. Snakes didn't have much society at all that Harry had ever heard of, and with thousands upon thousands of different species of snakes all over the world, how could they all use the same version of their supposed language, parcel tongue? Of course, that was all merely common sense. in which Harry was starting to lose faith entirely. But Harry was sure he had heard snakes hissing on the TV at some point. After all, he knew what that sounded like from somewhere, and that hadn't sounded to him like language, which had seemed a good deal more reassuring. At first. The problem was that Draco had also asserted that parcel mouths could send snakes on extended complex missions. And if that was true, then parcel mouths had to make snakes persistently intelligent by talking to them. In the worst-case scenario, that would make the snake self-aware, like what Harry had accidentally done to the Sorting Hat. And when Harry had offered that hypothesis, Draco had claimed that he could remember a story. Harry hoped to Cthulhu that this one story was just a fairy tale. It had that ring to it. But there was a story about Salazar Slytherin sending a brave young viper on a mission to gather information from other snakes. If any snake a parcel mouth had talked to could make other snakes self-aware by talking to them, then Harry didn't even know why his mind was going all then, when he knew perfectly well how the exponential progression would work. It was just the sheer moral horror of it that was blowing his mind. And what if someone had invented a spell like that to talk to cows? What if there were poultry mouths? Or for that matter. Harry froze in sudden realization just as the forkful of carrots was about to enter his mouth. That couldn't possibly be true. Surely, no wizard would be stupid enough to do that. And Harry knew, with a dreadful, sinking feeling, that of course they would be that stupid. Salazar Slytherin had probably never considered the moral implications of snake intelligence for even one second, just like it hadn't ever occurred to Salazar that Muggleborns were intelligent enough to deserve personhood rights. Most people just didn't see moral issues at all unless someone else was pointing them out. "Harry?" said Terry from beside him, sounding like he was afraid he would regret asking. "Why are you staring at your fork like that?"
"I'm starting to think magic should be illegal," said Harry. "By the way, have you ever heard any stories about wizards who could speak with plants?"
Terry hadn't heard of anything like that. Neither had any seventh-year Ravenclaws that Harry had asked. And now Harry had returned to his place, but not yet sat down again, staring at his plate of vegetables with a forlorn expression. He was getting hungrier, and later in the day he would be visiting Mary's place for one of their incredibly tasty dishes. Harry was finding himself sorely tempted to just revert back to yesterday's eating habits and be done with it.
"You've got to eat something," said his inner Slytherin. "And it's not all that much more likely that anyone sneezed self-awareness onto poultry than onto plants. So as long as you're eating food of questionable sentience either way, why not eat the delicious deep-fried diracol slices?" "I'm not quite sure that's valid utilitarian logic there." "Oh, you want utilitarian logic. One serving of utilitarian logic coming up. Even in the unlikely chance that some moron did manage to confer sentience on chickens, it's your research that stands the best chance of discovering the fact and doing something about it. If you can complete your work even slightly faster by not messing around with your diet, then, counterintuitive as it may seem, the best thing you can do to save the greatest number of possible sentient who-knows-whats is not wasting time on wild guesses about what might be intelligent. It's not like the house elves haven't prepared the food already, regardless of what you take onto your plate.
Harry considered this for a moment.
It was a rather seductive line of reasoning. Good, said Slytherin. I'm glad you see now that the most moral thing to do is to sacrifice the lives of sentient beings for your own convenience, to feed your dreadful appetites for the sick pleasure of ripping them apart with your teeth. What?
Harry thought indignantly.
Which side are you on here?
His inner Slytherin's mental voice was grim.
You too will some day embrace the doctrine that the end justifies the means.
This was followed by some mental snickering. Ever since Harry had started worrying that plants might also be sentient, his non-Ravenclaw components had been having trouble taking his moral caution seriously. Hufflepuff was shouting,
"Cannibalism!"
every time Harry tried to think about any food item whatsoever, and Gryffindor would visualize it screaming while he ate it, even if it was, say, a sandwich.
Cannibalism!
Oh, don't eat me!
Ignore the screams. Eat it anyway. It's a safe place to compromise your ethics in, at the service of higher goals. Everyone else thinks it's okay to eat sandwiches, so you can't use your usual rationalization about a small probability of a large downside if you get caught.
Harry gave a mental sigh and thought,
just so long as you're okay with us being eaten by giant monsters that didn't do enough research into whether we were sentient. I'm okay with that, said Slytherin. Is everyone else okay with that?
Internal mental nods.
Great. Can we go back to deep-fried Diraclaw slices now? Not until I've done some more research into what's sentient and what isn't. Now, shut up!
And Harry turned firmly away from his plate full of, oh, so tempting vegetables, to head toward the library.
Just eat the students, said Hufflepuff. There's no doubt about whether they're sentient. You know you want to, said Gryffindor. I bet the young ones are the tastiest.
Harry was starting to wonder if the Dementor had somehow damaged their imaginary personalities.
Honestly,
said Hermione. The young girl's voice sounded a little acerbic as her gaze scanned the bookshelves of the herbology stacks in the Hogwarts library. Harry had left her a message asking if she could come to the library after she'd finished breakfast, which Harry had skipped. But then, when Harry had introduced the day's topic, she'd seemed a bit nonplussed.
You know your problem, Harry. You've got no sense of priorities. An idea gets into your head, and you just go running straight off after it.
I've got a great sense of priorities, said Harry.
His hand reached out and grabbed Vegetable Cunning by Casey McNamara, and began to flip through the starting pages, searching for the table of contents.
That's why I want to find out whether plants can talk before I eat my carrots.
Don't you think that maybe the two of us have more important things to worry about?
You sound just like Draco,
Harry thought, but of course didn't say out loud. Out loud, he said,
what could possibly be more important than plants turning out to be sentient?
There was a pregnant silence from beside him as Harry's eyes went down the table of contents. There was indeed a chapter on plant language, causing Harry's heart to skip a beat, and then his hands began to rapidly turn the pages, heading for the appropriate page number.
"There are days," said Hermione Granger, "when I really, truly have absolutely no idea what goes on inside that head of yours. Look, it's a question of multiplication, okay? There's a lot of plants in the world. If they're not sentient, then they're not important. But if plants are people, then they've got more moral weight than all the human beings in the world put together. Now, of course, your brain doesn't realize that on an intuitive level, but that's because the brain can't multiply. Like, if you ask three separate groups of Canadian households how much they'll pay to save 2,000, 20,000, or 200,000 birds from dying in oil ponds, the three groups will respectively state that they're willing to pay $78, $88, and $80. No difference, in other words. It's called scope intensity. Your brain imagines a single bird struggling in an oil pond, and that image creates some amount of emotion that determines your willingness to pay. But no one can visualize even 2,000 of anything. So the quantity just gets thrown straight out the window. Now, try to correct that bias with respect to 100 trillion sentient blades of grass, and you'll realize that this could be thousands of times more important than we used to think the whole human species was. Oh, thank Azeroth. This says it's just mandrakes that can talk, and they speak regular human language out loud. Not that there's a spell you can use to talk with any plant. "Ron came to me at breakfast yesterday morning,"
Hermione said. Now her voice sounded a little quiet. A little sad, maybe even a little scared.
"He said he'd been dreadfully shocked to see me kiss you. That what you said while you were demented should have shown me how much evil you were hiding inside. And that if I was going to be a follower of a dark wizard, then he wasn't sure he wanted to be in my army anymore."
Harry's hands had stopped turning pages. It seemed that Harry's brain, for all its abstract knowledge, was still incapable of appreciating scope on any real emotional level, because it had just forcibly redirected his attention away from trillions of possibly sentient blades of grass who might be suffering or dying even as they spoke, and toward the life of a single human being who happened to be nearer and dearer.
"Ron is the world's most gigantic prat," Harry said. "They won't be printing that in the newspaper any time soon, because it's not news. So, after you fired him, how many of his arms and legs did you break?"
"I tried to tell him it wasn't like that,"
Hermione went on in the same quiet voice.
"I tried to tell him you weren't like that, and that it wasn't like that between the two of us, but it just seemed to make him even more like he was."
"Well, yes," Harry said. He was surprised that he wasn't feeling angrier at Captain Weasley, but his concern for Hermione seemed to be overriding that for now. "The more you try to justify yourself to people like that, the more it acknowledges that they have the right to question you. It shows you think they get to be your inquisitor, and once you grant someone that sort of power over you, they just push more and more.
This was one of Draco Malfoy's lessons which Harry had thought was actually pretty smart. People who tried to defend themselves got questioned over every little point and could never satisfy their interrogators. But if you made it clear from the start that you were a celebrity and above social conventions, people's minds wouldn't bother tracking most violations.
That's why when Ron came over to me, as I was sitting down at the Ravenclaw table, and told me to stay away from you, I held my hand out over the floor and said, "You see how I am holding my hand? Your intelligence has to be at least this high to talk to me." Then he accused me of, quote, "sucking you into the darkness," unquote. So I pursed my lips and went, and after that his mouth was still making those talking noises, so I put up a quieting charm. I don't think he'll be trying lectures on me again.
I understand why you did that,
Hermione said, her voice tight.
I wanted to tell him off too, but I really wish you hadn't. It'll make things harder for me, Harry.
Harry looked up from vegetable cunning again. He wasn't getting any reading done at this rate, and he saw that Hermione was still reading whatever book she had, not looking up at him. Her hand turned another page, even as he watched.
I think you're taking the wrong approach by trying to defend yourself at all,
Harry said.
I really do think that. You are who you are. You're friends with whoever you choose. Tell anyone who questions you to shove it.
Hermione just shook her head and turned another page.
Option two, Harry said. Go to Fred and George and tell them to have a little talk with their wayward brother. Those two are genuine good guys.
It's not just Ron,
Hermione said in almost a whisper.
Lots of people are saying it, Harry. Even Mandy's giving me worried looks when she thinks I'm not looking. Isn't it funny? I keep worrying that Professor Quirrell is sucking you into the darkness. And now people are warning me just the same way I try to warn you.
Well, yeah, said Harry. Doesn't that reassure you a bit about me and Professor Quirrell?
In a word,
said Hermione.
No.
There was a silence that lasted long enough for Hermione to turn another page, and then her voice, in a real whisper this time.
And Padma is going around telling everyone that since I couldn't cast the Patronus charm, I must only be pretending to be nice.
Padma didn't even try herself,
Harry said indignantly.
If you were a dark witch who was just pretending, you wouldn't have tried in front of everyone. Do they think you're stupid?
Hermione smiled a little and blinked a few times.
Hey, I have to worry about actually going evil. Here, the worst-case scenario is that people think you're more evil than you really are. Is that going to kill you? I mean, is it all that bad?
The young girl nodded, her face screwed up tight.
Look, Hermione, if you worry that much about what other people think, if you're unhappy whenever other people don't picture you exactly the same way you picture yourself, that's already dooming yourself to always be unhappy. No one ever thinks of us just the same way we think of ourselves.
I don't know how to explain it to you,
Hermione said in a sad, soft voice.
I'm not sure it's something you could ever understand, Harry. All I can think of to say is, how would you feel if I thought you were evil?
Harry visualized it.
Yeah, that would hurt. A lot. But you're a good person who thinks about that sort of thing intelligently. You've earned that power over me. It would mean something if you thought I'd gone wrong. I can't think of a single other student, besides you, whose opinion I'd care about the same way.
You can live like that,
whispered Hermione Granger.
I can't.
The girl had gone through another 3 pages in silence, and Harry had returned his eyes to his own book and was trying to regain his focus when Hermione finally said in a small voice,
Are you really sure I mustn't know how to cast the Patronus charm?
Harry had to swallow a sudden lump in his throat. He suddenly saw himself not knowing why the Patronus charm didn't work for him, not being able to show Draco, just being told that there was a reason, and nothing more.
Hermione, your Patronus would shine with the same light, but it wouldn't be normal. It wouldn't look like people think Patronuses should look. Anyone who saw it would know there was something strange going on. Even if I told you the secret, you couldn't demonstrate to anyone unless you made them face the other way so they could only see the light and the most important part of any secret is the knowledge that a secret exists. You could only show one or two friends if you swore them to secrecy.
Harry's voice trailed off helplessly.
I'll take it.
Her voice was still small.
It was very hard not to just blurt out the secret, right there in the library.
I shouldn't. I really shouldn't. It's dangerous, Hermione. It could do a lot of harm if that secret got out. Haven't you heard the saying, 3 can keep a secret if 2 are dead? That telling just your closest friends is the same as telling everyone, because you're not just trusting them, you're trusting everyone they trust. It's too important. Too much of a risk. It's not the sort of decision that should be made for the sake of fixing someone's reputation at school.
Okay,
Hermione said. She closed the book and put it back on the shelf.
I can't concentrate right now, Harry. I'm sorry.
If there's anything else I can do...
Be nicer to everyone.
The girl didn't look back as she walked out of the stacks, which might have been a good thing, because the boy was frozen in place, unmoving. After a while, the boy started turning pages again. Chapter 49. Prior Information. A boy waits at a small clearing at the edge of the non-forbidden forest, beside a dirt trail that runs back to the gates of Hogwarts in one direction, and off into the distance in another. There is a carriage nearby, and the boy is standing well away from it, looking at it, his eyes seldom wavering from its direction. In the distance, a figure is approaching along the dirt path. A man wearing professorial robes, trudging slowly with his shoulders slumped low, his formal shoes kicking up small clouds of dust as he walks. Half a minute later, the boy darts another quick glance before returning to his surveillance. And this glimpse shows that the man's shoulders have straightened, his face unslackened, and that his shoes are now walking lightly across the dirt, leaving not a trace of dust in the air behind.
"Hello, Professor Quirrell,"
Harry said without letting his eyes move again from the direction of their carriage.
"Salutations," said the calm voice of Professor Quirrell. "You seem to be keeping your distance, Mr. Potter. I don't suppose you see something odd about our conveyance?"
"Odd?" Harry echoed. "Why, no, I can't say I see anything odd. There seem to be even numbers of everything. 4 seats, 4 wheels, 2 huge skeletal-winged horses."
A skin-wrapped skull turned to look at him and flashed teeth, solid and white in that black, cavernous mouth, as though to indicate that it was just about as fond of him as he was of it. The other black, leathery horse skeleton tossed its head like it was whickering, but there was no sound.
"They are thestrals, and they have always drawn the carriage,"
Professor Quirrell said, sounding quite undisturbed as he climbed into the front bench of the carriage, sitting down as far to the right as possible.
"They are visible only to those who have seen death and comprehend it, a useful defense against most animal predators. I suppose that the first time you went in front of the Dementor, your worst memory proved to be the night of your encounter with he who must not be named."
Harry nodded grimly. It was the right guess, even if for the wrong reasons. Those who have seen death.
"Did you recall anything of interest thereby?"
"Yes,"
Harry said.
"I did."
Only that and nothing more, for he was not ready as yet to make accusations. The defense professor smiled, one of his dry smiles, and beckoned with an impatient finger. Harry closed the distance and climbed into the carriage, wincing. The sense of doom had grown significantly stronger after the day of the Dementor, even though it had been slowly weakening before then. The greatest distance that the carriage allowed him from Professor Quirrell no longer seemed like nearly far enough. Then the skeletal horses trotted forward and the carriage started in motion, taking them toward the outer bounds of Hogwarts. As it did, Professor Quirrell slumped back down into zombie mode, and the sense of doom retreated, though it still hovered at the edge of Harry's perceptions, unignorable. The forest scrolled by as the carriage rolled along, the trees moving past at a speed that seemed positively glacial by comparison to broomsticks, or even cars. There was something oddly relaxing, Harry thought, about travelling that slowly. It had certainly relaxed the defense professor, who was slumped over with a small stream of drool coming out of his slack mouth and puddling on his robes. Harry still hadn't decided what he was allowed to eat for lunch. His library research hadn't turned up any sign of wizards speaking to non-magical plants, or any other non-magical animals besides snakes. Although Spell and Speak by Paul Breedlove had recounted the probably mythical tale of a sorceress called the Lady of Flying Squirrels. What Harry wanted to do was ask Professor Quirrell. The problem was that Professor Quirrell was too smart. Judging by what Draco had said, the heir of Slytherin business was a major bombshell, and Harry wasn't sure he wanted anyone else to know. And the instant Harry asked about Parseltongue, Professor Quirrell would fix him with those pale blue eyes and say,
"I see, Mr. Potter. So, you taught Mr. Malfoy the Patronus charm and accidentally spoke to his snake."
It wouldn't matter that it shouldn't be enough evidence to locate the true explanation as a hypothesis, let alone overcome its burden of prior improbability. Somehow, the defense professor would deduce it anyway. There were times when Harry suspected that Professor Quirrell had way more background information than he was telling. His priors were simply too good. Sometimes he got his amazing deductions right, even when his reasons were wrong. The problem was that Harry couldn't see how Professor Quirrell could have snuck in an extra clue about half the stuff he guessed. Just once, Harry would have liked to make some sort of incredible deduction from something Professor Quirrell said, which would catch him completely off guard. "I shall have a bowl of green lentil soup with soy sauce," Professor Quirrell said to the waitress. "And for Mr. Potter, a plate of Denneman's family chili." Harry hesitated in sudden dismay. He'd resolved to stick to vegetarian dishes for the moment, but he'd forgotten in his deliberations that Professor Quirrell did the actual ordering, and it would be awkward if he protested now. The waitress bowed to them and turned to go.
Excuse me, any meat in that from snakes or flying squirrels?
The waitress didn't so much as blink an eye, only turned back to Harry, shook her head, bowed politely to him again, and resumed her walk toward the door. The other parts of Harry were snickering at him. Gryffindor was making sardonic comments about how a little social discomfort was enough to get him to resort to
cannibalism,
shouted by Hufflepuff, and Slytherin was remarking on how nice it was that Harry's ethics were flexible when it came to important goals like maintaining his relationship with Professor Quirrell. After the waitress had closed the door behind her, Professor Quirrell waved a hand to slide home the locking bar, spoke the usual four charms to ensure privacy, and then said,
"An interesting question, Mr. Potter. I wonder why you asked it."
Harry kept his face steady.
"I was looking up some facts about the Patronus charm earlier," he said. "According to the Patronus charm, wizards who could and couldn't, it turns out that Godric couldn't and Salazar could. I was surprised, so I looked up the reference in Four Lives of Power, and then I discovered that Salazar Slytherin could supposedly talk to snakes."
Temporal sequence wasn't the same as causation. It wasn't Harry's fault if Professor Quirrell missed that.
Further research turned up an old story about a mother goddess type who could talk to flying squirrels. I was a bit worried about the prospect of eating something that could talk.
And Harry took a casual sip of his water.
Just as Professor Quirrell said,
"Mr. Potter, would I be correct in guessing that you are a parcel-mouth?"
When Harry was done coughing, he set his glass of water back down on the table, fixed his gaze on Professor Quirrell's chin, rather than looking him in the eyes, and said,
"So, you are able to perform legilimency through my oculomancy barriers, then?"
Professor Quirrell was grinning widely.
"I shall take that as a compliment, Mr. Potter. But no."
"I'm not buying this anymore," Harry said. "There's no way you came to that conclusion based on that evidence."
"Of course not,"
Professor Quirrell said equably.
"I had planned to ask you that question today, in any case, and simply chose an opportune moment. I have suspected since December, in fact."
"December?" said Harry. "I found out yesterday."
"Ah, So you did not realize the Sorting Hat's message to you was in Parseltongue?
The defense professor had timed it exactly right the second time, too, just as Harry was taking a gulp of water to clean out his throat from the first coughing fit. Harry hadn't realized, not until just now. Of course, it was obvious the instant Professor Quirrell said it. Right. Professor McGonagall had even told him not to talk to snakes where anyone could see him, but he had thought she had meant not to be seen talking to any statues or architectural features in Hogwarts that looked like snakes. A double illusion of transparency. He had thought he understood her, she had thought he understood her. But how the hell?
So, Harry said, you performed legilimency on me during my first defense class to find out what happened with the Sorting Hat.
Then I would not have found out in December.
Professor Quirrell leaned back, smiling.
This is not a puzzle you can solve on your own, Mr. Potter. So I will reveal the answer. Over the winter holiday, I was alerted to the fact that the headmaster had filed a request for a closed judicial panel to review the case of one Mr. Rubius Hagrid, whom you know as the Keeper of Keys and Grounds at Hogwarts, and who was accused of the murder of Abigail Myrtle in 1943.
Oh, of course, said Harry. That makes it downright obvious that I'm a parcel-mouth. Professor, what the sweet slithering snakes...
The other suspect for that murder was Slytherin's monster, the legendary inhabitant of Slytherin's Chamber of Secrets, which is why certain sources alerted me to the fact, and why it caught my attention sufficiently that I spent a good deal of bribe money to learn the details of the case. Now, in point of fact, Mr. Potter, Mr. Hagrid is innocent. Ridiculously, obviously, innocent. He is the most blatant innocent bystander to be convicted by the magical British legal system since Grindelwald's confounding of Neville Chamberlain was pinned on Amanda Knox. Headmaster Dippet prompted a student puppet to accuse Mr. Hagrid, because Dippet needed a scapegoat to take the blame for the death of Miss Myrtle. And our marvellous justice system agreed that this was plausible enough to warrant Mr. Hagrid's expulsion and the snapping of his wand. Our current headmaster needs merely provide some new item of evidence significant enough to reconvene the case, and with Dumbledore applying pressure instead of Dippet, the result is a foregone conclusion. Lucius Malfoy has no particular reason to fear Mr. Hagrid's vindication, thus Lucius Malfoy will only resist to the extent that he can do so costlessly in order to impose costs on Dumbledore, and Dumbledore is clearly willing to prosecute the case regardless.
Professor Quirrell took a sip of his water.
But I digress. The new evidence that the headmaster promises to provide is to exhibit a previously undetected spell on the Sorting Hat, which the headmaster asserts he has personally determined to respond only to Slytherins who are parcel-mouths. The headmaster further argues that this favours the interpretation that the Chamber of Secrets was indeed opened in 1943, approximately the right time frame for he who must not be named, a known parcel-mouth, to have attended Hogwarts. It is rather questionable logic,
but a judicial panel may rule that it swings the case far enough to bring Mr. Hagrid's guilt into doubt, if they can manage to keep a straight face as they say it. And now, we come to the key question. How did the headmaster discover this hidden spell on the Sorting Hat?
Professor Quirrell was smiling thinly now.
Well now, let us suppose that there was a parcel mouth in this year's crop of students, a potential heir of Slytherin. You must admit, Mr. Potter, that you stand out as a possibility whenever extraordinary people are considered. And if I then further ask myself which new Slytherin would be most likely to have his mental privacy invaded by the headmaster, specifically hunting for memories of his sorting, why, you stand out even more.
The smile vanished.
So, you see, Mr. Potter, it was not I who invaded your mind, though I will not ask you to apologize. It is not your fault that you believed Dumbledore's protestations of respecting your mental privacy.
My sincere apologies,
Harry said, keeping his face expressionless. The rigid control was a confession in its own right, as was the sweat beading from his forehead, but he didn't think the defense professor would take any evidence from that. Professor Quirrell would just think Harry was nervous at having been discovered as the heir of Slytherin, rather than being nervous that Professor Quirrell might realize that Harry had deliberately betrayed Slytherin's secret, which itself was no longer seeming like such a smart move.
So, Mr. Potter, any progress on finding the Chamber of Secrets?
No,
thought Harry, but to maintain plausible deniability, you needed a general policy.